by the Catholic powers of Spain and France, was where God intended to bring the Reformed Protestant Church to perfection. All Englishmen had heard of the atrocities the Spaniards' hateful hunt for gold had inflicted on the Indians of America. England, it had been predicted by Richard Hakluyt, the chronicler of British exploration, would do it differently. It was the Leideners' patriotic and spiritual duty to plant a godly English plantation in the New World. "We verily believe and trust the Lord is with us," they wrote, "and that he will graciously prosper our endeavors according to the simplicity of our hearts therein." Their time in Leiden, they now realized, had been a mere rehearsal for the real adventure. "We are well weaned from the delicate milk of our mother country," they wrote, "and inured to the difficulties of a strange and hard land, which yet in a great part we have by patience overcome." Most important, however, they were knit together as a body in a most strict and sacred bond. They were weavers, wool carders, tailors, shoemakers, and printers, with almost no relevant experience when it came to carving a settlement out of the American wilderness. And yet, because of the extraordinary spiritual connection they had developed as exiles in Leiden, and even before, they were prepared for whatever lay ahead. "It is not with us as with other men," they confidently insisted, "whom small things can discourage, or small discontentments cause to wish themselves home again." Or, as one of their number, a 30-year-old corduroy worker named William Bradford, later wrote, "they knew they were pilgrims." Taking Bradford's lead, we refer to them today as the Pilgrims, a name that is as good as any to describe a people who were almost always on the move, even after they had supposedly found a home in America. If not for Bradford's steady, often forceful leadership, it is doubtful whether there ever would have been a colony. Without his Of Plymouth Plantation, certainly the greatest book written in 17th-century America, there would be almost no information about the voyage with which it all began. For William Bradford, however, the true voyage had begun close to 20 years before. Bradford was born in the tiny farming town of Austerfield, Yorkshire, deep in northern England, where the closest thing to a wilderness was the famed Sherwood Forest to the south. The Great North Road from London to Edinburgh, actually more of a ribbon of mud than a proper road, passed nearby, but few from Austerfield had ever ventured far from home. Although he came from a family of prosperous, land-rooted farmers, Bradford had experienced more than his share of dislocation and loss. By the time he turned 12, he had lost not only his father, his mother, and a sister, but also the grandfather who had raised him. Soon after moving in with his two uncles, he was struck by a mysterious ailment that prevented him from working in the fields. Bradford later claimed that his long sickness had saved him from the vanities of youth and made him the fitter for what he was afterwards to undergo. Most important, his illness gave him the opportunity to read. Lonely and intelligent, he looked to the Bible for consolation and guidance. For a boy in need of instruction, the Geneva Bible, translated in the previous century by a small team of English ministers and equipped with helpful notes and appendices, was just the thing. There was also John Fox's Book of Martyrs, a compelling, tremendously popular account of the Protestants martyred by Queen Elizabeth's Catholic predecessor on the throne, Bloody Mary. Fox's insistence that England was, like Israel before it, God's chosen nation had a deep and lasting influence on Bradford, and as Fox made horrifyingly clear, to be a godly Englishman sometimes required a person to make the ultimate sacrifice. At issue at the turn of the 17th century, and long before, was the proper way for a Christian to gain access to the will of God. Catholics and more conservative Protestants believed that the traditions of the Church contained valid, time-honored additions to what was found in the Bible. Given man's fallen condition, no individual could presume to question the ancient ceremonial truths of the established Church. But for the Puritans, man's fallen nature was precisely the point. All one had to do was witness a typical Sunday service in England, in which parishioners stared dumbly at a minister mumbling incomprehensible phrases from the Book of Common Prayer, to recognize how far most people were from a true engagement with the Word of God. A Puritan believed it was necessary to venture back to the absolute beginning of Christianity, before the Church had been corrupted by centuries of laxity and abuse, to locate divine truth. In lieu of time travel, there was the Bible, with the New Testament providing the only reliable account of Christ's time on earth, while the Old Testament contained a rich storehouse of still vital truths. If something was not in the Scriptures, it was a man-made distortion of what God intended. At once radical and deeply conservative, the Puritans had chosen to spurn thousands of years of accumulated tradition in favor of a text that gave them a direct and personal connection to God. A Puritan had no use for the Church of England's Book of Common Prayer, since it tampered with the original meaning of the Bible and inhibited the spontaneity that they felt was essential to attaining a true and honest glimpse of the divine. Hymns were also judged to be a corruption of God's word. Instead, a Puritan read directly from the Bible and sang scrupulously translated psalms whose meaning took precedence over the demands of rhyme and meter. As staunch primitivists, Puritans refused to kneel while taking communion, since there was no evidence that the apostles had done so during the Last Supper. There was also no biblical precedent for making the sign of the cross when uttering Christ's name. Even more important, there was no precedent for the system of bishops that ran the Church of England. The only biblically sanctioned organizational unit was the individual congregation. The Puritans believed that a congregation began with a covenant, a term they took from the Bible, between a group of believers and God. As a self-created and independent entity, the congregation elected a university-trained minister and, if the occasion should arise, voted him out. The Puritans also used the concept of a covenant to describe the individual's relationship with God. Ever since the fall, when Adam had broken his covenant of works with God, man had been deserving of perpetual damnation. God had since made a covenant with Christ. Upon the fulfillment of that covenant, God had offered a covenant of grace to just a small minority of people known as the saints. The Puritans believed that the identity of the saints had long since been determined by God. This meant that there was nothing a person could do to win salvation. But instead of being a reason to forsake all hope, what was known as predestination became a powerful goad to action. No one could be entirely sure as to who was one of the elect. And yet, if a person was saved, he or she naturally lived a godly life. As a result, the Puritans were constantly comparing their own actions to those of others, since their conduct might indicate whether or not they were saved. Underlying this compulsive quest for reassurance was a person's conscience, which one divine described as the voice of God in man. A Puritan was taught to recognize the stages by which he or she might experience a sureness of redemption. It began with a powerful response to the preaching of the Word, in which God revealed the heights to which a person must aspire if he or she was to achieve grace. This was followed by a profound sense of inadequacy and despair that eventually served as a prelude to, if a person was destined to be redeemed, saving grace. From this rigorous program of divine discipline, a Puritan developed the confidence that he or she was, in fact, one of the elect. For William Bradford, who had lost almost everyone he had ever loved, this emotionally charged quest for divinity would lead not only to the assurance of his own redemption, but to the family he had never known. Bradford was just 12 years old when he became uneasy with the way God was worshipped in Austerfield. Like just about every village in England, Austerfield possessed a small stone church built soon after the Norman conquest in the 11th century. But the Austerfield church, known as St. Helena's, was, and is, unusual. Over the door is a primitive stone carving from a much earlier era depicting an open-mouthed snake. One can only wonder whether this weird, almost runic figure first suggested to the young Bradford that the Puritans were right. The Church of England had been poisoned by that old serpent Satan. He must seek out a congregation of like-minded believers and worship God as the Bible instructed. In Scrooby, an even tinier town than Austerfield, a few miles down the road in northern Nottinghamshire, he eventually found what he was looking for. In an old manor house, just a few decades from being demolished, lived the town's postmaster, William Brewster. It was here that a group of separatists gathered every Sunday to worship in secret under the direction of two ministers, one of whom was the young John Robinson. Taking their cue from Paul's admonition, "Come out among them and be separate," the separatists were Puritans who had determined that the Church of England was not a true Church of Christ. If they were to remain true to their faith, they must form a church of what were known as visible saints, members of the elect who upheld each other in the proper worship of God. If members of the congregation strayed from the true path, they were admonished. If they failed to correct themselves, they were excommunicated. Purged of the ungodly, a separatist congregation shared in an intense fellowship of righteousness that touched every facet of every communicant's life. The separatists believed in spiritual discipline, but they also believed in spontaneity. After the minister concluded his sermon, members of the congregation were encouraged to prophesy. Instead of looking into the future, prophesying involved an inspired kind of improvisation. An extemporaneous attempt by the more knowledgeable members of the congregation to speak, sometimes briefly, sometimes at great length, about religious doctrine. By the end of the service, which lasted for several hours, the entire congregation had participated in a passionate search for divine truth. Adding to the intensity of the spiritual bond shared by the separatists in Scrooby was the fact that they were engaged in an illegal activity. During the previous century, several separatists had been jailed and even executed for their beliefs. And since the coronation of King James in 1603, the pressure to conform to the Church of England had been mounting. From James's perspective, all Puritans were troublemakers who threatened the spiritual integrity of his realm. And at a gathering of religious leaders at his palace in Hampton Court, he angrily declared, "I shall harry them out of the land." In the years since the Hampton Court conference, increasing numbers of men and women had been prosecuted for their unorthodox religious beliefs. As separatists, the congregation at Scrooby was in violation of both ecclesiastical and civil law, and all of them undoubtedly knew that it was only a matter of time before the authorities found them out. Sometime in 1607, the Bishop of York became aware of the meetings at Brewster's Manor House. Some members of the congregation were thrown in prison, others discovered that their houses were being watched. It was time to leave Scrooby. But if King James had vowed to harry the Puritans out of England, he was unwilling to provide them with a legal means of leaving the country. A person needed official permission to voyage to the continent, something the authorities refused to grant religious nonconformists such as the separatists from Scrooby. If they were to sail for Holland, they must do it secretly. For a group of farmers and artisans, most of whom had rarely, if ever, ventured beyond the Nottinghamshire-Yorkshire region, it was a most daunting prospect. But for 17-year-old Bradford, who would lose the people upon whom he had come to depend if he did not follow them to Holland, there was little choice in the matter. Despite the vehement protests of his friends and relatives, who must have pointed out that he was due to receive a comfortable inheritance at 21, he decided to sail with John Robinson and William Brewster to a new land. Their escape from England did not go well. The first captain they hired turned out to be a traitor and a thief, who surrendered them to the authorities in the Lincolnshire town of Boston. After their leaders had spent several months in jail, they tried again. This time they secured the services of a trustworthy Dutch captain who planned to meet them on the southern bank of the Humber River, just above the town of Grimsby. But they'd loaded no women and children and only a portion of the men onto the ship when the local militia appeared. Fearing capture, the captain determined to sail for Amsterdam, leaving the women and children weeping in despair as their husbands looked on from the deck of the departing ship. It was several months before they were all reunited in Holland. Once in Amsterdam, the separatists from Scrooby found themselves thrust into conflict and contention. As dissidents who had come to define themselves in opposition to an established authority, separatists were often unprepared for the reality of being able to worship as they wanted in Holland. Relieved of all doctrinal restraint, the ministers of several English separatist congregations began to advocate positions that put them at odds with their own flocks. The minister of an English congregation from Gainsborough, only a few miles from Scrooby, had decided to reject infant baptism. Another minister attempted to quell a messy series of personal scandals by claiming that he and his elders, or church officers, could dictate policy to their congregation. As fellow English separatists, it was impossible for the newcomers from Scrooby to avoid being embroiled in these quarrels if they remained in Amsterdam. Showing the firmness, sensitivity, and judgment that came to characterize his ministry in the years ahead, John Robinson led the majority of the congregation to the neighboring city of Leiden, where they were free to establish themselves on their own terms. In Leiden, Robinson secured a house not far from the Peterskerk, one of the city's largest churches. In the garden behind Robinson's home, they created a miniature village of close to a dozen houses. Even though approximately half the congregation lived in houses elsewhere in the city, what was known as De Groene Poort, meaning the green lane or alley, came to represent the ideal of Christian fellowship they would aspire to for the rest of their lives. William Bradford soon emerged as one of the leading members of the congregation. When he turned 21 in 1611, he sold the property he had inherited in Austerfield and used the proceeds to purchase a small house. A fustian, or corduroy worker, Bradford became a citizen of Leiden in 1612 in recognition of his high standing in the community. In 1613, he married Dorothy May, and 4 years later, they had a son, John. But Bradford's life in Leiden was not without its setbacks. At one point, some poor business decisions resulted in the loss of a significant portion of his inheritance. In typical Puritan fashion, he interpreted this as a correction bestowed by God for certain decays of internal piety. From the beginning, the pilgrims exhibited all the strengths and weaknesses of a group held together by a most strict and sacred bond. When circumstances turned against them, they demonstrated remarkable courage and resilience. Indeed, adversity seemed to intensify their clannish commitment to one another. Once established in Leiden, they acquired a renewed sense of purpose, despite or because of the hardships of exile. Leiden was a thriving city of 40,000, but it was also a commercial center that required its inhabitants to work at a pace that must have come as a shock to farmers from Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire. A life of husbandry involved periods of intense labor, but its seasonal rhythms left long stretches of relative inactivity. In Leiden, on the other hand, men, women, and even children were expected to work from dawn to dusk, 6 days a week, with a bell sounding in the tower of the yarn market to announce when work was to begin and end. As the years of ceaseless labor began to mount, and their children began to lose touch with their English ancestry, the pilgrims decided it was time to start over again. The members of Robinson's congregation knew each other wonderfully well, but when it came to the outside world, they could sometimes run into trouble. They were too focused on their own inner lives to appreciate the subtleties of character that might have alerted them to the true motives of those who did not share in their beliefs. Time and time again, during their preparations to sail for America, the pilgrims demonstrated an extraordinary talent for getting duped. It began badly when William Brewster ran afoul of the English government. In Leiden, he had established a printing press, which he ran with the help of the 20th